In the second week, thank you so much, Derek. We're in the second week of a series which is a leading up to Easter. It's an Easter series, but it's also a continuation in its own right of the discipleship series we did beginning of the year. And in a sense, I've decided to go all the way back to the beginning of the story, into Genesis 1 through 12. And to, on one hand, show how, as Peter and the book of Revelation say, Christ was founded even before, Christ was crucified even before the founding of the world. How and why was that possible? And why was it that God knew that there would be a requirement of crucifixion at some point, according to his creation? And also, if discipleship's the answer, what is the question? What is the resolution it's trying to solve? Why do we need to be disciples? You could say, Christ has saved me, all is well and done. What's the point of me being discipled to Christ if he saved me? He's done all the work, I do nothing now. So discipleship has a role. It's not salvation taking place of what Christ has done, but it's definitely something necessary in our lives. So in a sense, I think in the story of Genesis 1 through 12, we see very clearly why Jesus Christ was necessary at Easter and why he's necessary to follow and have Lord and Master of our lives today. We looked at Genesis 1 and 2 last week, and we came to these four conclusions, or at least I did, and so therefore you did too, that when God created, he created out of desire, not out of need. He didn't need to create us, but he wanted to. This was a passion project in which he was delighted and said every day, this is good, this is good. That creation is necessarily ordered. Everything God did to begin was to create order. He separated light from dark to create time. He separated the heavens from the earth to create space. He created space between the waters and the dry land. He made things ordered so that he could then fill it with life. And so life and abundance is connected to the idea of being orderly and everything in its place. We can see as well that in creation story, it reflects God's own passion. God is life, right? He doesn't just have it, he is life. And everything that he makes is made with that energy, with that life. And we can see in the one command that he gives that we've had no trouble following and do not feel resentment, and that is to be a fruit and multiply. There is a drive in us to replicate, to reproduce, and we and all other creatures commanded to do so want to because we have God's lust for life in us. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. But finally, this lust for life, though godly and very good, it's not tame. It poses challenges. As the writer of Ecclesiastes put it, God has set eternity in our hearts, which means that we mortal beings have immortal longings, and that creates a tension. So Genesis 3 to 4, somehow, even though the sex drive is about the most obvious manifestation, if you like, of God's lust for life in us, it certainly doesn't answer the question, why did Adam and Eve fall, and why Cain and Abel? Sex wasn't related to any of those issues. So my job, I suppose, my task I've set myself, the problem I've painted myself into a corner on is, how does passion, desire, God's eternal longings result in or have its part to play in the downfall of humanity? Or to put it another way, how do I reconcile that we have legitimate needs, but too often meet them by illegitimate paths? We have genuine and good and right godly desires, but we like to find alternative ways of meeting those according to the scriptures. So we start with Adam and Eve. When Eve looked on the forbidden fruit, what did she see? What did she see? Here it is sitting in the garden. I'm glad they took a photo for us. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, delightful to look at, and that it was desirable, there's that word, for obtaining wisdom. So she took some of its fruit and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. What's wrong with this? When I was 13, I had decided to spend the year reading all the way through the scriptures, beginning to end. I think probably I had a plan and it would have divided old and new up into sections so that I could get a bit of both at the same time. When I came to that part about King Solomon, who had recently become king, and he's burdened with the responsibility of this entire nation, and David had a lot of good things. He was not a very good father. So King Solomon had an incredible responsibility and a terrible example in his fatherhood. And so God chose to be his dad to him. There's a lovely scripture about this. And he meets him in a dream and he says to Solomon, I will give you whatever you want. Ask and it's yours. I wonder what you would say. And Solomon, feeling the burden of responsibility, said to God, grant me wisdom so that I can rightly rule this vast and incredible nation of yours. And God said, that's a wise choice, already showing wisdom. And because you didn't ask for what most others might have asked, power, riches, fame, long life, you will have them as well, along with wisdom. I remember making that same prayer, thinking that, well, let's be wise. Maybe I'll get riches and fame. It seemed an appealing idea anyway, the idea that you would pray for wisdom. Much of the Bible is wisdom literature, isn't it? Extolling to us that wisdom is among the most highly prized things you could have. Far greater than riches and fame, better to be wise. The Bible bangs on about the importance of wisdom, and for good reason. Is it wrong to seek wisdom? No, according to the Bible. And Adam and Eve also shouldered a great responsibility under God. He said to them that you are to rule and subdue the earth. The picture that we have in Genesis is that though he orders things and creates this pinnacle of his own cultivation called the Garden of Eden, beyond the bounds of that particular garden, there's still a lot of untamed space. And he wants his people who bear his image to go out and rule and subdue as him, like him, for him, and with him. So like King Solomon, do you think they sat there thinking, we could do with a bit of wisdom? That feels like a big role. God gave us unique tools to act as his agents on earth. We have the power of reason, don't we? Intelligence, a unique intelligence. We have consciousness. We are aware of ourselves in a way that a tree is not. You will not get much conversation out of a tree. We are unique. And God gave us those powers so that we could rule and subdue. But he also gave us not just the ability to know, but the want to know, the desire, the passion. Who, when they're on holiday, can't help but set up a jigsaw puzzle? I mean, it's an exercise in frustration most of the time, but we get joy out of it, solving the puzzle. Some people have every day, they have a little puzzle thing they do, maybe on their phone, they have something they like to work out. What's that? Is it Wordle? What's that? You've got to work out the puzzle. We just want to know. We don't just have the ability, we have this drive, don't we? A passion to know. And so God, knowing this about us because he made us like this, dangles in front of Adam and Eve a tree with the very fruit they might desire in order to do the work. And then he forbids them from eating it. prohibition itself is probably enough to make them interested. It's a kindergarten over the side here, right? Off to your left. 5 days a week, little kids. Like Adam and Eve, they could go naked and unashamed because they're innocent. They're innocent. Now imagine this scenario. I take a bottle of bleach, plain white bottle, and I just leave it in the playground somewhere. Now, the teachers there fill their days with fun activities, lots of exciting things, colors and things to jump off and sand to pile up and throw into each other's eyes, lots of interesting things. The white bottle of bleach is the least interesting thing and unlikely, don't you think, to draw any attention. Now imagine another scenario. I go into that playground first thing in the morning and I take the bottle of bleach and I set it down and I say, now kids, gather around me. Don't drink or you will die. What do you think happens next? Now, I bet you every one of them would say, of course we wouldn't dare. But if you were able to track their eyeballs and do a heat map of that kindergarten for the next few hours, that bottle, plain white bottle, will be the most fascinating thing in the whole playground. In fact, I bet you, and here I'm about to get myself in trouble, a little girl, unlikely to be a little boy, will say, here is the perimeter around this bottle of bleach. Don't even come close. Which sounds an awful lot like Eve, doesn't it? Who was, when the serpent said, did God really say you can't eat from any tree? Clearly just drawing attention to this one tree. She says, no. We can eat from any tree but this one. Oh, we're not even allowed to touch it. Like, I've just drawn a little invisible perimeter around it. Don't even touch it. Adding to what God said. Which I think demonstrates that the serpent didn't need to work very hard to draw her attention to the tree because she was already very aware of it. All that needed to happen was for God to say, don't eat it or you'll die. It suddenly becomes the most interesting thing to a people who are driven to know, telling us you're not allowed to touch, to taste, to see, to eat. Oh boy. That is the one thing we need to know now. So Eve looks upon the fruit and her role as governor and steward of creation with Adam and realizes, oh, this is good for wisdom. It didn't need much prompting. And I don't blame Eve as if excluding or excusing Adam. They were both there. So she takes it and together they eat it. And the serpent was right, their eyes were opened. But their hearts were darkened. They gained knowledge at the cost of their innocence. They could no longer be naked and not feel shame. Shame enters the story. And so they run off to hide and to cover themselves. When we try to meet a true and legitimate need through illegitimate means, there are consequences. So it asks or begs the question, what might be a legitimate path? Why give us this power to know, this drive to seek, and then put all these prohibitions in place? What is going on? Let me suggest to you that if we're seeking wisdom, the words of Solomon in Proverbs 25:2 aren't bad. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, the glory of kings to search out a matter. It doesn't mean a Google search, does it? What is it saying? It's saying that God enjoys concealing things. Why? Because when we search them out, when we do the work, when we put in effort and make discoveries through hard labor, through legitimate effort, there is glory. I wonder whether today's AI is just the modern day version of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You don't have to work for knowledge anymore. Why know anything if you can just ask AI? It promises, doesn't it, to tell us by bringing together all the information on the internet, which is a great deal, certainly far more than in my lifetime or many lifetimes could ever plumb, and say, I'll give you the answer. Why work for something you can just reach out and take? I can promise you, I will never preach a sermon written by AI. And it's less for your sake than it is for mine. Why would I outsource or give to something else the glory of spiritual discovery? Why would I give to something else and make easy the work that would bring me closer to God? There was nothing wrong with the pursuit of wisdom. The thing that was wrong was taking it without earning it. Had they simply said, no, it's not right to take it, they would already have been wiser. And they would have earned it by resisting, by making a good decision. And all this neatly segues to Cain and Abel. Both display a desire for God. They both make a sacrifice to God, but only one really wants it, a relationship. And we know that this story takes place after the consequences of Adam and Eve's decision. Because of what they did, they're now cut off from the tree of life. So death has entered into the story for humanity. We could have, at that point, have eaten from the tree of life and could have continued to live. But cut off from that, we now die. They also struggle under a new level of chaos and disorder according to their parents. There's now conflict between husband and wife. As it says, she will desire him, which is a way of saying she wants to consume him, have him in a way that's unhealthy. But instead, he will rule over her, which both are not God's intention for the relationship at all. There's additional pain and heartbreak in child-rearing, which we see immediately too in the heartbreaking story of Cain and Abel, as two parents watch their sons consume each other. There is now enmity, mutual pain and conflict between humans and the serpent, whatever this creature is. And the earth itself now will resist man's efforts to cultivate it. It's going to sweat it out to try and make food, and it's going to produce from thorns and thistles as much as anything else. And of course, there's tension now between God and humans. That ease of relationship that was in the story of Genesis 1 and 2, that he would walk with God in the cool of the evening, it's not so possible anymore. There is a fracture, there is a wound in that relationship. Shame has entered. But God does not abandon them. We'll get to that in a minute. Now, Abel, second son of Adam and Eve, seems to recognize and acknowledge this break in relationship, this change between humans and God, but he wants to do something about it. There is still a relationship possible. It's not over. And he decides to invite God to dinner. Now, I'm not being that facetious here. When we think of the sacrificial systems of the ancient peoples, it was really genuinely the idea of offering food to the gods. The temples, when they had the temples were considered the houses for the gods. The food put into the temples was for the gods to eat. So I'm not really being facetious. Think of it in that way, that Abel wants to invite God to dinner. Now, if this is a relationship where there's been some wounding, some issues, some tensions, Abel knows that the best way to go about soothing the relationship or putting your best foot forward or saying, I really treasure resolving the conflict, you put on the best meal possible, right? Which is what Abel does. He takes his very best, his first and least and most perfect lamb, and he offers that to God, and God accepts it. Cain, on the other hand, he gets KFC. He pays for it himself, for sure, but he doesn't go to a lot of effort. He's thinking, I want a relationship with God. I need to solve and soothe this. what is the least effort I could put in? Wanting a relationship with God is a legitimate desire. It's a good thing. Trying to get one with the least effort, where do you think that leads? Now, God is not offended, really. Cain is. Cain is the one offended, even though he offends God. Cain is the one offended because Abel's offering, his dinner, was accepted by God as an olive branch of peace. And Cain's was not, because God could see what was in Cain's heart. And he says, Cain, be very, very careful what you do next, because sin is crouching at your door and it seeks to devour you. In the story of our immortal longings, our passions, our desires, if we don't learn to master them, they will master us. If we don't learn to direct them into legitimate right paths, also known as paths of righteousness, we will end up in places we do not wish to be. And so God is appealing to Cain, you are about to be consumed by your own unrighteous passions. Don't act rashly. But of course he does. Well, again, I ask you, how many here have received excellent advice only to ignore it? How many of here who have received excellent advice, ignored it, suffered the consequences, and realized that was excellent advice? I'm now going to take it because the pain of ignoring it is greater. Cain decides, well, KFC wasn't enough. What's a better sacrifice that still won't cost me much? And he kills two birds with one stone by killing Abel. One, he offers a pretty prime sacrifice that costs him nothing. Thank you. In Cain's mentality, that's the ideal sacrifice. I will take nothing from my own storehouses, the minimum of my own cost, and I'll remove a rival for God's affections. He's going to have to accept me now. And of course, it doesn't work. Like his parents, he chose the easy road. The path of getting what he wanted at the minimum cost, without effort, without real sacrifice, and he suffered. And so Cain is cursed. His livelihood as a farmer, it's over. The soil will not accept his work. It remembers the blood of Abel, and it's not going to serve him. And so he's left to wander. And he, in fact, as the story goes on, he is the first city builder. And what else can he do? But importantly, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Philip and Rebecca, Christine and Peter, Alistair and Myra, God does not abandon us no matter what we do. When Cain was told he was cursed to wander, he cried out in horror and said, well, if someone finds me, they'll kill me. And God said, don't worry, I've put a mark on you, the mark of Cain. It's a protective mark. It says to anyone who sees Cain, do not touch. I am protecting this person. This person is under my personal protection. It hardly seems like a God who just loves to reject and throw away even those who reject him. So we come to a conclusion now for our story so far. It is human to take shortcuts, isn't it? To have legitimate desires, and yet, whether it's laziness or whatever it is, we seem to look for ways to make life easier in a way that does not lead to life being better. And shortcuts don't work. Shortcuts don't work. But in the same story, against that backdrop of humanity's stupidity, is God's grace. We see it in allowing us to face the consequences of our decisions. I think one of the hardest things of being a parent is not stepping in and preventing your children from facing the consequences of their actions. I'm too self-centered. I don't want to feel the pain of seeing them suffer. But God is big enough for it. More to the point, he has guaranteed that there is no thing that we would suffer that he can't completely reverse. I've put the picture of the cross there because we know behind this story of God's humanity's rebellion and stupidity and propensity to sin is this underwritten guarantee behind all of creation. I know you're going to mess it up. That's why I'm going to fix it. I know you'll make mistakes. I also know that you'll learn your lessons in those mistakes, and you will come to me when I arrive. You will see my grace, and you will want to have a way that is right. You will want a life that leads to righteousness and to goodness. I've underwritten all of creation with my own sacrifice. That is why he allows us to face, why facing consequences is not a bad thing in God's economy, because it might lead us to repentance. It might lead us to recognize that we've made mistakes and we need another way. And so his grace is there. And facing them with us, he does not leave us alone, even in our worst situation. He faces them with us, hoping to lead us back. Salvation means I do not pay for my own sins. Discipleship means I get to learn how to live a righteous life with Christ. I want both. I want both. And I can only praise Christ for being both. I'd like to lead into communion. Before we do that, Matthew's